My presentation here is really an exposition of chapter 3 of the book God, An Introduction to Problems in Theology. And I think it's really a wonderful place to consider Fabro's account of the proofs of the existence of God and his unique contribution. And so my task here is really expository, and I'll just say a few kind of reflective remarks at the end as well. So Fabro begins this section by just orienting us in terms of the church's magisterium. What has the church really said as a matter of guidance for us on the possibility of a rational demonstration of God's existence? When he really wants to give us a sense of the importance of this issue. It says the intellect tends to truth, and so everyone, regardless of where they're at, is forced to pose the problem of God. And the meaning and value of truth has its foundation in God. He's the essential truth, and every created truth is truth by participation in him. So the existence of God is the problem of problems. It's a consummation of philosophy and of ordinary and scientific human knowledge. So the orientation of our life, in a way, depends on it. And yet, at the same time, God's not an object of sense experience, so we have to seek him through reflection and discursive reasoning. That's Fabro's little intro. And then he takes us, really, I think this is one of the great contributions, to just orient us in terms of the church's statements on the possibility of the rational demonstration of God's existence. And he begins with the clearest and kind of strongest statement we find in Vatican I in the document Dei Filius. Quote, "If anyone shall have said that the one true God, our Creator and Lord, cannot be known with certitude by those things which have been made by the natural light of human reason, let him be anathema," according to the anathema kind of form of saying things. And then it cites Romans, the beginning of Romans. Quote, "Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes of eternal power and divinity have been able to be understood and perceived in what he has made." And then, of course, Wisdom 13 as well we could use as a scriptural citation to ground the possibility of rational demonstration of God's existence. Fabro also includes Psalm 19. "The heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament proclaims the work of his hands." I think another place to look that's very good is Acts chapter 17, Paul at the Areopagus, where we get that beautiful line where Paul is quoting a Greek author, "In him we live and move and have our being." So Fabro situates us in terms of the church's magisterium. He doesn't just present Vatican I as occurring out of nowhere. He says, well, actually, there was a certain degree of buildup to this in the 19th century, and he cites several documents that you could go through to see. And then he says, further, we have Leo XIII and Eterni Patris weighing in on this issue. "The demonstration of God's existence is, according to him, a great and noble fruit gathered from human reason." Also, a number of things mentioned by Pius X as well. And, we can, of course, bring this further in time into the 90s, into Fides et Ratio, when John Paul II urged philosophers to recover the genuinely metaphysical range of their discipline and to press on and pose the question of God's existence and its rational demonstration. I like this beginning because in much the same way that St. Thomas begins different issues, I'm thinking especially of Trinitarian theology, Fabro's doing that for us here. St. Thomas will often situate things in terms of the two extremes, the two edges of the cliff, or the two bumpers that we need to be aware of. So in Trinitarian theology, St. Thomas begins his treatise on the Trinity really saying, okay, well, what are the two heresies that show us we're going too far in either direction? And so for that, it's modalism or Sabellianism on the one side and Arianism or subordinationism on the other, which emphasizes, says that the Son is a creature. And then on the other, you're just talking about God having different modes or names. That's a way to frame the theological reflection. Here are the two errors on either extreme. So Fabro's doing much the same thing for us with the regard to the question of demonstrating God's existence. He says that on the one hand, there are errors of defect, and on the other, there are errors of excess. So the errors of defect are those that deny it's possible that God's existence be rationally demonstrated. And so this includes atheism and agnosticism, but also, strangely enough, on that same extreme is fideism, or a certain kind of traditionalism that says, no, you need faith in order to know God exists. It's absolutely necessary. So that's the side of the defect. On the other side, the errors of excess, we have theories that assume a kind of immediate knowledge of God, that God is the first thing known, the primum cognitum, rather than being in a different sense. So obviously that's another kind of error, and closely related to that is the claim that God's existence is self-evident to us. St. Thomas, of course, goes through in the Summa, it says, no, God's existence is not self-evident to us, even though in a way it's self-evident to God, it's self-evident in itself. So there's extremes on either side, and we're situated within them, and our reflection takes place within them. We want to maintain that knowledge of God is possible, but not easy. And Fabre also gives us a list of what we can expect from everyone, from the common man, quote-unquote. And it's kind of a funny list. Like, what can we expect everyone, you know, as a bare minimum, to be able to admit to? It says, well, one, admission of the external world. The external world exists. And you think, well, there may be people that deny that, but you're probably only going to find them in philosophy faculties. Number two, consciousness of one's own I, of one's own ego. And then three, the validity and objectivity of knowledge. Again, something you may find people challenge, but probably only within a more exclusive philosophical discourse. Moving on to section two in this chapter, Fabre really places a huge amount of emphasis, I think rightly so, on the principle of causality. So this section is just called the value of the principle of causality. And really, it's the kind of end point of the whole discussion of magisterial teaching. It says, well, if we take all of these different magisterial declarations of the 19th century and, you know, even taking them further into our own time with John Paul II, what are they telling us? Say, well, it's possible to demonstrate God's existence. It's possible to know that God exists by the use of reason alone. And then, in these magisterial statements, there's a suggestion, a kind of marching order for us in our philosophical reflection, that a suggestion that our demonstrations ought to begin with the principle of causality, with the existence of creatures considered as an effect of divine power. This is very interesting. And it's helpful for us, too, to know, you know, when people say, oh, well, you like Thomas Aquinas too much, which, you know, frequently happens, and if you're a Dominican, people say, but, and you want to say, okay, fair enough, the church has not canonized a particular philosophy. The church has canonized certain philosophers, but, and here we can be playful, the church only canonizes philosophers per accidens. In other words, the philosophy itself is not canonized, but there can be a strong suggestion, and I think we see that with Aquinas and the number of times he comes up in the magisterial statements. And a kind of strong recommendation from the popes through the centuries to study Aquinas. So that's all a way of saying that the magisterial statements don't say, oh, and by the way, Aquinas' five ways are really what does it, you know. It's not as though the five ways themselves are being canonized or being definitively declared as the ways that lead us to arrive at the demonstration of God's existence by reason. Rather, what we get out of the magisterial statements is instead just a suggestion that, well, your starting point better be the principle of causality. Creatures as effects of divine power. This is, you know, may not seem like the church has given us much by saying this, but actually it's a great deal, because there's other ways that you could begin. There's other ways that people propose. And so I think, you know, in this very philosophical work, in this very theological work, Fabre's giving us the magisterial statements as a way to orient us and a way to get us started. And so he then goes into a long discussion of the principle of causality, which he calls the cornerstone of the proofs of God's existence. And he goes through objections to the principle of causality given by Hume and by Kant. I could go through those a little bit more in detail, but since there's already been a talk on the principle of causality, I'll go ahead and pass over those. It's only to say that the modern controversy, which Fabro talks about, the neo-scholastic controversy over the principle of causality is very relevant, and it centers around whether it can be said that the principle of causality is an analytic or synthetic statement. Basically, where this one way of summarizing it is it self-evident, or is it a first principle in the true sense, meaning something that we grasp intuitively and immediately? And the answer is sort of yes and no. And Fabro ends up saying something to the effect that, well, there's a first sense in which something can be self-evident, a first and primary sense, where there is a connection between the subject and predicate rooted in terms of the ontological content of the terms. So the most basic sense of being a first principle. But then what he ends up in this chapter saying is, well, this first principle is self-evident, but in a secondary mode, in a secondary way, because it requires a third party. It requires something else outside of just the very terms of the statement. So he actually doesn't go into that in great detail. I presume he does in other works, certainly in the longer work defending the principle of causality. But so for now, I'm going to pass over that a little bit and just get to where he goes in this chapter. And that is really to give us a rigorous formulation of the principle of causality. So he talks about really, in order to defend ourselves against modern critiques and to arrive at the principle in its most, in its strongest form, with the greatest conceptual purity, as well as the greatest immediacy, the language he uses, we need to really describe the principle of causality in a different way, some way that gives us a sense of the ultimate metaphysical dependency at work in causality. So the subject must include all that can be said to depend or have a real relation of dependency. And so the terms must immediately express ontological dependency. And I'm sure many of you are aware of this importance of this principle in Fabro's thought, and even the kind of autobiographical element of it as well, that he had a profound eureka moment in his 20s in the course of revising his work on causality, his sogno speculativo, his speculative dream. Would that I had more speculative dreams. I think Thomas Aquinas had them. He did theology in his sleep. And so Fabro had, of course, this great eureka moment when he discovered the profound connection between the principle of causality and participation. And it literally involved waking up in the middle of the night, so far as I understand, to read the account, and flipping open the Summa and looking at question 44 and seeing causality spoken of in terms of participation. And then subsequently, I guess maybe later that day, maybe, I don't know, maybe he kept reading Aquinas all night. He found similar statements in the Commentary on the Sentences and in a wonderful work I wish that we read more as Thomas, the De Substantiis Separatis. And that's really, this is all going to cash out in the formulation of the principle of causality as such. Every being by participation depends on the being by essence. And so Fabro tells us that Thomas uses this principle to talk about creation ex nihilo and also to get to the essence-esse distinction, at least in one argument for it. He says, it's amazing, you know, how many times can you say, this is the thing, this is the principle, this is what I want you to focus on. But he does, and he does in rather vivid and beautiful language. He says, this formulation of the principle confers on Thomism its character of a definitive synthesis of classical and Christian thought. The formula of participation represents the ultimate theoretical instance. And it doesn't exclude lower levels of metaphysical consideration according to the diverse conditions in the hierarchy of the real. The five ways all have different starting points and elaborate a relationship of dependence, but they all arrive at the same end, the existence of God as the first absolute principle of every modality of being, a song in five voices, from the superficial movements of being, things moving around, cause and effect relationships, necessary and contingent things, to the profound reality that constitutes them. So really, it's with this almost poetic transition that Fabro goes into the third section, where he actually talks about the demonstrations of the five ways. He makes a few brief comments about how Aquinas draws primarily from Pseudo-Dionysius's Triplex Via in his early works as methods for advancing knowledge of divine perfections through causality, remotion, and immanence. Remotion, of course, is kind of the same thing as the via negativa, or as one scholar puts it, Norman Kretzmann calls it the way of elimination, process of elimination. That's in our language. That's easy enough to understand. And then there's the way of immanence, not imminence, but immanence. Finite perfections proceed from the fullness of divine perfections according to participation. Their exemplars are in God. So creatures are really ways for our intellect to be led to God. So that is a way of summarizing Aquinas' earlier reflections on proofs for God's existence and his natural theology. And then Fabre also makes a brief comment that in the Summa Contra Gentiles, so a little bit earlier work than the Summa Theologiae, Aquinas gives the versions of the five ways that are there are really based very closely on Aristotelian principles. But then, again, with a great deal of poetry, Fabre says that the five ways present in the Summa proceed with the fluidity of a clear stream. There's an Aristotelian element, but it's assimilated into the angelic doctor's clear exposition. And even the fourth way, which we associate with Platonism, Neoplatonism, has a kind of Aristotelian justification. So these are Fabro's way of saying all of this is they're steps of a single path towards the original source of being. And so rather than actually go through all of the proofs, Fabro just gives us the text, pretty much, in this chapter at least. But he says that there's two parts to each proof. What do they all have in common? Well, each has two parts. You have a premise taken from the order of experience. So that's what we're familiar with naming them by. Proof from motion, efficient causality, contingency, grades of perfection, and finality. That's the first part of all of them. But then in the second, there's the heart of the argument that unfolds in a way that corresponds to that first metaphysical fact, he says. And the Fabre says, well, I can't summarize the proofs for you because I just told you how beautiful the text is. And so then he reproduces the text for us in this chapter. And at the end, he mentions that, you know, even medievals had plenty of objections to these five ways. But then he really focuses on the modern objections and says, well, really, a lot of people have gotten the five ways wrong. They say that Aquinas only arrived at an Aristotelian unmoved mover who's not a true creator. And Fabre says, well, no, you're missing the point. Aquinas has, in the spiritual climate of Christian creationism, recovered Aristotelian realism's robust structure of the real without its historical limitations. It's so funny to see this text translated now. You know, because when I was reading Fabre in the Italian, I'm thinking, well, this is rather poetic and long-winded. And then you see it translated, it's even that way in English when you translate it. So it's like I was getting it right. I feel justified now to see more Fabre in English. Fabre points out, and I think this is one of his great contributions in this chapter, the importance of another section of text, and that is the prologue to the commentary on John, in which not five but four ways are given, four ways that philosophers arrived at God. And I think, yeah, these texts are extremely important. And they're ways that philosophy was nourished, even before the coming of Christ, was nourished by the word himself, by Fabre says, by a kind of inner attraction. And so what are these ways? Well, first, there's knowledge of God through his authority, which is an interesting way to say it, through his authority. But really, it's something like the fifth way, through finality, through final causality. Only an intelligence which transcends the world can explain finality. Unintelligent things attain useful and certain ends, and so it's a sign that they're ordered by a governing intelligence. This is, again, in the commentary on John, the prologue to the commentary on John. The second way there is eternity. The more noble something is in terms of it, which grade of being it falls in, the less changeable it is. And so the first principle, we reason, is supreme and changeless and eternal. And so the scriptures give us this language in saying that God is seated on a high and lofty throne. And John, the evangelist, points to the divine eternity when he simply says, "In the beginning was the Word." Fabro says that this actually is the most Aristotelian of the ways given here. I think it sounds awfully Platonic as well. Perhaps that's a sign that we're making a little bit of a false dichotomy. The third argument given in the commentary on John is from the dignity of God. And this is attributed explicitly to Plato. And Fabro thinks this is the best articulation of the fourth way. And since there's a talk devoted to that, I'll go ahead and pass over. And the fourth is from the incomprehensibility of truth. You wouldn't think that'd be a very good argument for the truth of God's existence. What does he mean by it? Well, all the truth that we can comprehend is finite. And Augustine says, "Everything known is bound by the comprehension of the one knowing." The first supreme truth, which surpasses every intellect, must be incomprehensible. And this is God. And so the scriptures signify this in the word lofty, or in saying no one has ever seen God. I'd like to go further into this, but just a side remark that Fabro mentions, that Aquinas uses this argument in the Summa Contra Gentiles to prove the immortality of the soul, something that we need to spend more time thinking about, I think, rational demonstration of the immortality of the soul, especially in light of all those folks out there who don't realize they have a spiritual soul that survives death. There's an interesting praise that Aquinas has of John the Evangelist's contemplation. It says that contemplation is full when one can consider all the effects in the cause itself, when one knows the essence of a cause and its power as it extends to many things. So in other words, when one can see the rivulets as radiations flowing from a supreme source, but then also to know the source and the way that they flow out. So St. Thomas gives this little homage to John the Evangelist. You'd say, why does he like John the Evangelist so much? Is it because he was the beloved disciple, the one that reclined on the breast of our Lord? All of these other things we might say, the one who loved so much. He says, well, actually here, St. Thomas praises John the Evangelist with a very Neoplatonic way of praising. He says, "The Gospel of John contains altogether what the other sciences, moral, natural science, and metaphysics, have in a divided way, so it's most perfect." It's a very Neoplatonic way to praise an evangelist. "What is higher possesses a greater unity, and higher things contain the perfection of lower things in a more preeminent and simple modality." So again, John was the beloved disciple, but here he's also being praised as, in a way, a kind of model philosopher. We might think that this is an obscure text, the commentary on John, but Fabro has us remember that, well, Aquinas thinks these ways are conclusive. They could also stand in addition to the five ways of the Summa Theologiae. Just sort of wrapping up the exposition, Fabro gives a brief comment at the end saying that, well, there's a big difference between Aquinas' arguments and the ontological argument of Anselm. Again, another common misconception that people have about Aquinas' arguments. And then in the last section, a very curious section, which I won't spend any time going into, Fabro talks about science and faith in the Magisterium of Pius XII and takes some of Pius XII's statements about the sciences giving us evidence of mutability and finality, and using that as yet sort of further evidence for demonstrations of God's existence. So, how would we summarize what Fabro gives us in this chapter, which is composed of many different parts? Well, he gives us an orientation to the magisterial statements on the possibility of the rational demonstration of God's existence. And he really gives us, as a fruit of that, a focus on the principle of causality. And then he orients us to a proper understanding of the principle of causality and the issues surrounding it by talking about Hume and Kant and others in the 20th century. And so then he reformulates the principle of causality in terms of participation and gives us a brief sketch why he thinks that's so important. And then he briefly introduces the five ways of the Summa Theologiae and, as an important complement, the four ways of the Commentary on John. But I think perhaps a great thing to take from this, if it's the only thing you take, is the different images that Fabro gives us to describe the relationship among the five ways, among the various ways of proving God's existence. He says that their voices forming a harmonious song, or with the language of flowing, which is again a very Neoplatonic thing to say, rivulets flowing out from one source, which we ascend to. So he suggests that not all of these proofs are equal. Some might take us further up the mountain, but it's important to have an appreciation for all of them. And so Fabro's real contribution in this chapter is giving us this overview. What are the fundamental conditions for the proofs for God's existence to be able to work? And how do Aquinas' arguments in particular form a kind of whole? So he doesn't go into great detail into each of the arguments, but he shows us the importance of the principle of causality as the cornerstone of the proofs. And perhaps he's just left the dots for us to connect. So we could ask, if we were to go further, how is the principle of causality at work, particularly in ways 1, 2, 3, and 5? It's clear the connection with the fourth way. He has plenty to say about that elsewhere as well. You can plug very easily the principle of causality in terms of participation into the fourth way. It's right there. However, it's a bit harder to see how the principle of causality expressed in terms of participation is a part of ways 1, 2, 3, and 5. So the first way with act and potency, or with the second way, causality, efficient causality, it might be easier for us to plug in an earlier form, a less conceptually pure form of the principle of causality, to just describe a cause and an effect. And then more can be said about the third and fifth way. So really, if we had a pressing question to ask Fabro right now, here's what I would ask. Are you saying that the principle of causality must be expressed in terms of participation before it can be employed in any proof for God's existence? You might say that's option A. Or are you saying rather that at some point in our philosophical journey, we'll really need to better formulate the principle of causality in terms of participation in a way, again, that combines conceptual purity and notional immediacy? Is he saying that as what we need in order to have a satisfying and robust natural theology? So those are the two options. Is it absolutely necessary even to have any of the proofs work? Or is it more just a kind of destination really for us to arrive at on our journey eventually? I'm much more comfortable with the second option, the option B. I don't really have a settled opinion here. I spent a great deal of time just arriving at this question, so I'm pretty proud of it. And I'm happy to hear your thoughts on this and what you think he's actually telling us, or if he's even given us the ability to answer that question right now. I'm interested in this question also because of its practical application. Namely, if you're going to introduce people to the idea of a demonstration of God's existence, where should we start? If we're going to start guiding someone down the path of natural theology, whether to begin evangelizing an atheist or beefing up the intellectual reflection of a theist for our fellow Christian, it's worth knowing where the best starting point is. Where should we start? Should we start with the fourth way? I know that Fabro thinks it's the most formal and abstract, and I think for him, that's his way of saying it's the best. means something very different coming from other people. Say, well, how was the talk? Well, it was formal and abstract. Aquinas notably says that the first way is the most evident, and I think that might be a strong suggestion we should use it first. Also the fact that it comes first in the order. So we could go back and forth on this, but it might be helpful to look at our goals. We have a limited way of looking at the five ways if we just think of them in terms of whether they work or not. We're really painting a full picture, and we want to use the demonstrations of God's existence as well as a way to account for a larger and more robust natural theology, because each one gets us to a certain divine attribute or moves us in that direction. So this is really what I'm building towards as a kind of image. Fabro suggests the image of a mountain. He doesn't say it explicitly, but he talks about ascending to God, so we can use this image. At the summit of this mountain is a spring, the original source for all the water flowing down the mountain in different rivulets. And that summit really is God as ipsum esse, or esse per ascensiam, the ultimate summit we hope to arrive at. God as the cause of all esse, the being by essence on which every being by participation depends. And the fourth way takes us all the way up there, but it might be a very steep climb. It's a very steep metaphysical learning curve, and not everyone can just go right for it, because philosophical reflection is hard enough as it is. Many should probably start on a less steep slope and follow less steep rivulets. So perhaps the fifth way is something that'll really get people started, or the third, or the first, even though that one has a big metaphysical learning curve too, because we have to ever understand act and potency. So to avoid turning things into a sporting event where we each take our favorite argument for God's existence and cheer for it, I think it's helpful for us to have Fabro's attitude towards the five ways as a whole. In a way, regardless of where we start, we should acquaint ourselves with all of the ways for our metaphysical formation to arrive at a better understanding of God. And so to do so already takes us well into natural theology. We want to be well acquainted with all the paths leading to the mountain, leading to the summit, just so that we know the mountain better and the summit we're reaching. We want to acquaint ourselves with the whole circumference of starting points, the whole radiation of effects springing from the same fontal source. So I'll just end again with that quote from Fabro. There are five different points of departure, but with the identical end of the existence of God as the first absolute principle of every modality of beings. It's a song in five voices which springs from the boundless expanse of beings, from their superficial movements, to the profound reality which constitutes them. Thank you.